powers of will, mental strength, and even fear. That tightly wound ball of purpose drifted into limbo that summer of 1993 as he neared a vortex of trouble and pain. Leading him there was James Jordan, whose world was likewise collapsing around him. He faced a paternity suit by a Chicago woman. The businesses he had started with Larry after the Flight 23 fiasco were now failing, as authorities moved in to collect unpaid taxes and suppliers began removing items from store shelves over unpaid bills. He was engaged in a furious battle with Dolores. Joint bank accounts were closed, thus destroying the final shred of credit for his business. Payroll was unmade, and each phone call from his secretary seemed to bring yet more troubles. According to his older daughter, her father wearily complained to his children that his wife was trying to ruin him in the eyes of his children. On July 22, 1993, James and Dolores Jordan each left their home in a Charlotte suburb and headed off in different directions. Mrs. Jordan caught a flight to Chicago to visit her son, and Mr. Jordan got into his cranberry-colored Lexus and headed across the state to Pender County to bury an old friend. The Lexus, a gift from his son, was an item of pride for James Jordan. The vanity license plate read UNC0023. The next day he was scheduled to fly to Chicago to enjoy a celebrity baseball game his son was hosting. Afterward, his wife and son were scheduled to take an extended vacation in California. Mr. Jordan's 57th birthday had come and gone by the time his older daughter took a phone call from his secretary on August 2nd. She told Sis that she was alarmed. While James Jordan usually checked in every day, the secretary had not heard from him in almost 2 weeks. It was then that the daughter learned of the dire circumstances of her father's business. Payroll checks had bounced, causing employees to walk off the job. The secretary also told the daughter that Mr. Jordan had missed his flight to Chicago on July 23rd. For years, James Jordan had traveled for days at a time, trying to keep pace with his son's busy schedule. He would go off alone a lot, his son explained later, sometimes if he and my mother had a disagreement, or just to be on his own. He enjoyed retirement so much and doing whatever he wanted to do whenever he wanted to do it, so it wasn't peculiar. Sis then phoned her mother, who had just returned home after nearly 2 weeks on the road, and relayed the secretary's concerns. Dolores Jordan noted that the house appeared just as she had left it, and that it appeared no one had slept in the beds. But she sought to allay her daughter's concerns, saying that wherever James Jordan was, she was sure that was where he wanted to be. Growing concern. On August 4th, Sis again phoned her father's business and discovered that he still had not checked in. 2 days later, she learned that her mother and Larry had visited the business and that Dolores Jordan had paid the outstanding bills. To the daughter, the payment seemed a sign that perhaps her parents were beginning to get past their conflicts. That weekend, Sis phoned her mother, who said she suspected that Mr. Jordan was in Hilton Head, where he was thinking of moving. Several days later, a neighbor phoned and told Sis to turn on the television. James Jordan's Lexus had been found stripped and vandalized. It was upon hearing the same news that Michael realized something was dreadfully wrong. He treasured that car, Jordan said later. Police had found the Lexus on August 5th near a wooded area off a main road in Fayetteville, North Carolina. The back window was smashed out, and the car had been stripped of its stereo speakers, tires, and vanity plates. Authorities had tracked the vehicle through a Lexus dealership and then contacted the Jordan family. Authorities searched the area around the vehicle but found nothing. They were able to determine that Mr. Jordan had attended the funeral July 22nd, then visited with a female friend that evening before leaving to make the 3.5-hour drive home to Charlotte. It is not unusual for Mr. Jordan not to let someone know where he's at for a couple of days, but certainly not for 20-plus days, Captain Art Bender of the Cumberland County Sheriff's Department told reporters. Upon receiving the news, Michael left for North Carolina. Authorities soon connected the car to a badly decomposed body that had been found August 3rd in a swampy creek near McCall, South Carolina. The local medical examiner later acknowledged that the remains had been placed in a body bag and left in the bed of his pickup truck for most of the day. South Carolina authorities eventually conducted an autopsy, took photographs, and determined that the victim had died of a single .38-caliber gunshot wound to the chest. On August 7th, a part-time coroner had collected the jawbones and hands from the unidentified corpse and ordered the remains cremated. It was my decision as to what I had to do, the coroner, Tim Brown, told reporters after it was confirmed that the victim was Michael Jordan's father. I had a body that was decomposing and there was no means of refrigeration. Stunned by the notification, the Jordan family began making hurried arrangements for a funeral that weekend at the Rockfish AME Church in Tichy. Meanwhile, authorities quickly tracked calls made from a cell phone in the Lexus to two 18-year-olds from Lumberton, North Carolina. On the same day as the Jordan family held the service in Tichy, authorities arrested Larry Martin Demery and Daniel Andre Green and charged them with first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit armed robbery, and armed robbery. Green had been paroled 2 months earlier after serving less than 2 years for a conviction in Robeson County for assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill and armed robbery, according to Robeson County Sheriff Hubert Stone. James Jordan, according to investigators, had become a victim of circumstance when he stopped his car in a well-lighted place along Interstate 95 near Lumberton in the early morning hours of July 23rd. The teenagers were armed and had reportedly talked of robbing someone that night as they waited at a nearby exit when Jordan apparently pulled off the road to rest, said Captain Art Binder. The two shot and killed Jordan and discovered who he was only when they looked in his wallet, Binder said. Once they realized that it was Michael Jordan's father, they wanted to make sure they tried to cover their tracks the best way they could. It took them a while before they decided South Carolina would be the place they would put the body. They drove 30 miles to a remote area just across the South Carolina border, where they dumped James Jordan into the Swampy Creek. They kept the Lexus 3 more days, took videos of themselves boasting about the event, then left the car on a dirt road on the outskirts of Fayetteville, about 60 miles from where they dumped the body. As this matter unfolds, you will find that what happened to Mr. Jordan was the kind of random violence that all the public are concerned and afraid of, said Jim Komen, director of the North Carolina Bureau of Investigation. It could have been any one of us. The speculation. The circumstances immediately created an outbreak of conspiracy theories. Why was there a rushed cremation? Why wasn't James Jordan reported missing? How could he have been gone for weeks without his family suspecting anything? Did the murder involve Michael's gambling? How could his 57th birthday have passed with no one in his family even noticing that he was missing? The mystery deepened after Dolores Jordan told authorities that her husband had last spoken with her on July 26th, and a local convenience store clerk reported that she had seen someone who looked like James Jordan with the two teens in her store several days after the reported crime date. Investigators later concluded that both were mistaken. The family, meanwhile, faced an emotional ceremony that Sunday, August 15th. The church was packed, with many more outside as Jordan walked slowly to the pulpit to address 200 mourners, including B.J. Armstrong, Ahmad Rashad, and David Falk. "I've always wondered how it felt to stand behind one of these," he said with a slight smile. Jordan spoke softly, in a voice that cracked with emotion, of his father's qualities. He thanked both his parents and talked of the efforts they had made to provide for their children's upbringing and education and to encourage them to set goals to live by. "Don't dwell on his death, but celebrate the life he lived," Jordan said of his father. He then held his mother tightly, smiling and whispering in her ear as he escorted her out of the church to the graveyard. James Jordan was remembered by many in the community as the industrious young man eager to show that he knew how to get things done. "He would keep you laughing all the time," James Jordan's 71-year-old second cousin, Reverend Andre Carr of nearby Rocky Point, told the Tribune. "It seemed like he always had something funny to say. There was something about his spirit, his sense of humor, that he was a friend of everybody. You'd meet him, and it was like you knew him all your life. He was the type of father who liked everything to be uplifting. He was such a happy guy." The following Thursday, Jordan released a statement through Falk's office. "The many kind words and thoughtful prayers have lifted our spirits through difficult times," he said. "I also want to express my appreciation to the local state and federal law enforcement officers for their efforts. I'm trying to deal with the overwhelming feelings of loss and grief in a way that would make my dad proud. I simply cannot comprehend how others could intentionally pour salt in my open wound, insinuating that faults and mistakes in my life are in some way connected to my father's death." He targeted unsubstantiated reports as particularly galling for his family. Jordan had been scheduled to play in the Rose Elder Invitational Golf Tournament that Friday at Lansdowne Resort in Leesburg, Virginia. The following Tuesday, he also faced a decision about whether to attend his own Michael Jordan Ronald McDonald Children's Charity Celebrity Golf Classic at Seven Bridges Golf Club in Woodridge, Virginia. He ultimately decided to make a low-key appearance at both events, even as speculation over his father's death continued to occupy airwaves. "That's what killed us about Norm Van Leer here in Chicago," Phil Jackson recalled of the former Bulls guard turned broadcaster. "He was broadcasting theories about Michael's father's death and gambling and the NBA and all this stuff. Michael had to go talk to Van Leer and say, "Norm, cool this stuff about gambling and the NBA and the grand scheme and all this other stuff about my father's death. There's no conspiracy going on here." That's the paranoia that builds in people's minds and sometimes drives you crazy. From their earliest days together, Jackson had shown a strong intuitive sense of how to support and sustain Jordan. The coach had become Jordan's companion and guide, and Jordan did the same for Jackson as their ideas and separate visions had invigorated one another. But basketball had no place in Jordan's thoughts as he struggled with his father's death over the ensuing weeks. As training camp neared that fall, David Falk informed Jerry Reinsdorf that Jordan was prepared to retire. James Jordan's death wasn't mentioned as a reason, but the owner knew that the trauma of the loss was driving the decision. There would be immediate speculation that Jordan was retiring in protest over a contract that left him woefully underpaid. But Reinsdorf refuted that. "Michael said to me, 'This is not about money. I don't want to play basketball anymore. I want to be retired.'" "What do you want to do?" Reinsdorf asked Jordan. "I want to play baseball," Jordan told him. The owner recalled that he had asked Jordan if he had spoken with Jackson, and Jordan replied that he was hesitant to do that. "Knowing Phil, the psychology major, he was going to try to get in my head and see where I stood," Jordan recalled. Jordan, though, knew what he wanted. While Jackson certainly knew how to push his buttons, the coach was careful to tread softly when they met. He pointed out that Jordan possessed a great gift from God and that leaving the game would deny millions of fans the benefit of that gift. Jackson said he should think over his decision, but Jordan was firm. "No, this is it," he said. Jordan had a question of his own for Jackson. He wanted to know how the coach would get him through another 82-game regular season because he had absolutely no motivation, saw no challenge in it. Jackson had no good answer. Jordan didn't want to end his career on a down note with declining skills and facing excessive criticism the way Julius Erving had finished. So Jackson changed course one final time and asked Jordan if he had thought about a sabbatical. But that wouldn't do. Jordan wanted no lingering, no loose ends. Jackson realized it then and told Jordan he was on his side. Then the coach told him that he loved him and began weeping. Although he had braced himself for a difficult encounter, Jordan was caught off guard by the emotion, especially when he informed his teammates and coaches. Tony Kukoc, who had just come to the United States to play with the Bulls, had gotten particularly emotional, which struck Jordan in return. His other teammates seemed similarly affected. He realized then that people could spend years working together and not know the depth of their feelings for each other. Johnny Bock recalled Jordan informing the coaching staff. He said, "I'm going to retire, guys. I couldn't believe it. We wished him luck. It was a shattering day." On October 6, 1993, Jordan publicly announced his retirement from the Bulls. "I would have made the same decision with my father around," he said during the announcement. "5 years down the road," he said, "if the urge comes back, if the Bulls will have me, if David Stern lets me back in the league, I may come back." The comment would spark yet more intrigue and speculation that Jordan, during his discussions with David Stern, had been told to retire, perhaps even forced out. Dave Kindred again weighed in. "Was there a trade-off? Hey, MJ, you retire, we drop the investigation. Was Jordan advised, ordered by NBA Commissioner David Stern to go away, go play baseball or something, and let the gambling stories die?" Sports Illustrated also noted the speculation that Jordan was leaving to avoid the NBA's latest investigation of his wagering and that Jordan didn't mention his gambling in the news conference. Falk and Stern both said emphatically there was no link between Jordan's gambling and his retirement, with Stern adding that for anyone to even suggest that was scurrilous and disgusting. Stern told reporters that the league's latest investigation of Jordan was now closed, emphasizing that he was certain Jordan had never bet on NBA games and was not suffering from gambling addiction. Much later, in a 2005 interview with Ed Bradley on 60 Minutes, Jordan appeared to finally acknowledge the problem. "Yeah, I've gotten myself into situations where I would not walk away and I've pushed the envelope," Jordan told Bradley. "Is that compulsive?" "Yeah, it depends on how you look at it. If you're willing to jeopardize your livelihood and your family, then yeah." As Sonny Vaccaro observed, Jordan was so big, so important to the NBA, he was the only player who could have survived the gambling mess. "A lesser player would have been suspended," Vaccaro said, adding that the NBA chose to deal with it by shutting the books on its inquiry. It seemed highly unlikely that David Stern would have forced Jordan from the league. Jordan, however, would later express anger with Stern for not doing more to take on the conspiracy theorists who tied James Jordan's death to his son's gambling debts, even though nothing in any investigation pointed to that possibility. The move to retire came so swiftly that he had no time to notify his mother, who was in Africa. "I was in Kenya with Michael's mom and a group of school kids," recalled Bulls Vice President Steve Shanwald. "It had been so peaceful out there. We were on safari in a remote portion of Kenya, living in tents. No newspapers, no radio, no TV, no nothing. I told the people that the world could be coming to an end and we wouldn't know. 2 days later, we flew back to Nairobi, back to civilization for the first time in about 10 days. I got off the plane and got on the bus that was going to take us to have lunch. The bus driver was reading a newspaper, a tabloid called the Daily Nation, Kenya's national newspaper. On the back page, there was a picture of Michael, and the headline said, 'Michael Jordan retires.' I thought it was somebody's idea of a bad joke. But 2 days earlier, Michael had announced his retirement. Apparently, Michael's mom didn't know. I went up to her and thanked her for lending us her son for 9 great years. She said, 'What are you talking about?' I said, 'Mrs. Jordan, your son retired 2 days ago.' She said, 'He did? I don't believe it.' So I went and got the newspaper and showed her. That was how we found out about Michael retiring. That night at dinner, I bought some champagne for everybody and we toasted Michael on his great career. But by the time I got back to Chicago, the festive mood was gone. People were definitely depressed. It happened with such suddenness, it was so out of the blue that it kind of took the wind out of people's sails. Perhaps the greatest emptiness was felt by the NBA's leadership, who now had to replace the greatest attraction in basketball history. Ironically, there were also reports that Stern had asked Jordan not to retire, but neither man discussed the moment in detail. That question would linger forever, another knot in the great mass of Jordan's resentment. Chapter 30, The Diamond Dream. Steve Kerr arrived in Chicago not long before the Bulls opened their training camp in 1993. A free agent guard with slow feet, a shock of blonde hair and a deadly shot, he brought a mix of eagerness and concern to the task of making the roster. He'd heard all the stories circulating around the NBA about how difficult it was to be Jordan's teammate. But within a week of signing his contract, Kerr saw the Jordan factor mysteriously disappear. Instead, his only MJ connection over the coming weeks would be a glimpse of Jordan when he slipped in to observe the practices of the team he had just deserted. The void Jordan left was profound. He had long hinted at his departure. Now, soon after the announcement, he was back as if to ascertain exactly what his absence looked like, in hopes that the finality of it might actually help him find his way. By his own admission, the newfound family time that he could now embrace did nothing to ease his mental state. He was still grieving, something his public and the media had failed to recognize, and trying to formulate a direction for his new life. He came every once in a while, Kerr remembered. He would just come in and watch practice. I think he just wanted to see the guys and stuff. So we saw him a few times. He came to some games that year, sat in a suite at the United Center. Even this silent specter on the sidelines at practice seemed intimidating, a reminder of how the team was about to evolve. "I think it really sort of became Phil's team at that point," Kerr observed. "Even though I wasn't there before that, I'm sure Phil was dominant and his presence was felt before that, but it really became Phil's team after Michael retired, because it had to be. He was the dominant presence. The characters, the egos we had on the team, we had some great players, but you know, Scotty was never a guy who was going to seize control of a team from a leadership standpoint. He was everybody's favorite teammate, but one of the reasons for that was he was vulnerable, and Phil was not vulnerable." Some observers had underestimated Jackson, suggesting that his success was a function of Jordan's ability, but they had failed to grasp just how dominant a personality the coach presented. That became essential on a team whose best player was beset by insecurity and was battling management over his pay. A few years earlier, Pippen had insisted on a long-term contract that quickly became obsolete as the league salaries grew. Although the team did agree to return money that he had deferred, Reinsdorf was not going to renegotiate. "I think Scotty was vulnerable because he was human," Kerr explained. "It's the reason everybody loved him. You know, he signed that long contract. He was clearly underpaid. It was tough for him to live with that. He felt like he wasn't appreciated. All the feelings that are associated with almost every human being, that was Scotty. And that's why we all really appreciated him, because we felt we were more like him. even though we weren't physically. We were all more like him emotionally than like Michael. Michael didn't even seem human, he was so confident and so strong. Jordan would quickly begin to appear considerably less superhuman. He had been lost since his father's murder in August, and each succeeding account of the details served to intensify his grief, as he would acknowledge later. Yet he was also drawn to it, pausing whatever he was doing whenever another story about his father and the subsequent arrests popped up on television. Jordan had rarely projected frailty or weakness, but now he was privately in search of relief. Word began to circulate that fall that, with Reinsdorf's blessing, he had been showing up at the White Sox training facilities at Comiskey Park to take batting practice on the sly. In typical Jordan fashion, he was there 5 days a week, sorting out a game he hadn't played in more than a decade, with the help of White Sox players Frank Thomas, Mike Huff, Dan Pasqua, and Julio Franco. He had his sights set on returning to the game his father had loved dearly and had continued to talk about, even as Jordan had come to rule basketball. It was really his father's dream that he play baseball, Phil Jackson observed months later. His father wanted to play pro ball and did play semi-pro. When his father passed away, I think Michael was kind of living out his father's dream. That's one of the things I thought when I heard it. Geez, this guy wants to go play baseball in the major leagues? But then I realized, basketball players are always fantasizing that they could play baseball. The Sox. Jordan revealed his plans to Chicago Tribune columnist Bob Green, with whom he had worked on the book Hang Time. They were driving past Comiskey Park one day, when Jordan indicated that might be a place he would soon be working. The ride itself was revelatory to the columnist because of the often manic behavior of people they encountered all over the city. Grown men stopping their cars in traffic and jumping out, or rapping on his Corvette window to get Jordan to sign a piece of paper. Green was amazed to see that Jordan had more or less come to accept these sometimes alarming intrusions as part of his daily routine. No wonder he spent so much time in hotel rooms with a door double bolted, the columnist thought. But by now the star was used to offering up just about every shred of his privacy to the hungry god of his public being. He had made a trip to California, where he was riding bicycles along the beach with a friend, when they encountered a pickup game in a park. Jordan wanted to join them, and when his friend approached the players, they thought he was kidding until they saw his airness in the flesh standing nearby. He then jumped in and regained a bit of that old joy with the game. But a huge crowd gathered in an amazingly short time, and he had to leave before it turned crazier. Jordan told Green he was thinking about using the scene for a new commercial, and the columnist couldn't tell if he was joking. Green kept the baseball news to himself, but others in Jordan's circle were beginning to process the idea. Sonny Vaccaro, now working for one of Nike's competitors, remembered Jordan calling him about the decision. He said, "Here's what I'm thinking of doing," and he convinced me. He told me he was going to do it. I never heard anybody suggest he do it. He said, "I'm going to try the baseball." He always thought he was a baseball player. He said that's how he was going to deal with it, and it was easy for him to do because he relished that challenge. Vaccaro was struck that with Jordan's decision to play baseball, the issue of his gambling would just go away for the NBA. It wasn't easy for Michael, but he realized he'd made some poor decisions, and he apologized to the people affected and he moved on, David Falk later said, giving the conspiracy theorists a new morsel on which to feed. It took a lot of guts to retire when he did. It took a lot of guts to go play baseball and run the risk of failure after being incredibly successful at something else. But Michael is fearless. Jordan phoned Bob Green in January to break the story officially. He had continued working at the Comiskey training facility for weeks with a plan of going to spring training with the White Sox in Sarasota, Florida. This was not a fantasy baseball scenario, Jordan told Green. This was to be the real deal. There would be plenty of doubters, but he had always been driven by those betting against him. For many, the question became, was it a penance, or a pilgrimage, or both? He arrived in Sarasota just days before his 31st birthday, along with Green, who was working on another book. The first day was telling. There were the White Sox in t-shirts and shorts ready for calisthenics, and at his locker was Jordan, fully dressed in his game uniform, number 45, like a youngster waiting for Little League to start. All of a sudden, I felt like a kid again, he had said earlier, of the anticipation. The only difference was the legendary approach, which would prompt White Sox hitting coach Walt Riniak to describe him as one hard-working motherfucker, and when you told him something, he listened, Riniak would marvel. Not that either of those things would make it easy to turn him into a big league player. He hadn't played organized baseball since he quit the Laney High School team in March 1981. But in his determination to learn to hit big league pitching, Jordan came early and stayed late each day at spring training. Still, the futility was obvious almost from the start. Much of it had to do with the sheer size of his legend. Anticipating his big moment, thousands of fans had descended upon Sarasota. Team officials had erected barriers around Ed Smith Stadium just to handle the crowds. Spring training had always been a sleepy affair, but now there were extra security and PR people everywhere, and escorts to and from the team bus, and the press was out in force. Crowds of people pressed against the chain-link fences, all of them wanting autographs, which Jordan dutifully tried to oblige, another problem in that it again contrasted with his teammates' habit. Players had refused to sign for years, citing their union agreements, which had long left Reinsdorf shaking his head in disgust. But here was Jordan obliging crowds of autograph hunters and conducting press conferences, threatening to widen the gulf with his new teammates, some of whom treated him coolly from the start. Jordan's escape from all this was the house he had rented in a nearby gated community. There he could sit on the back deck at night, gazing up at the stars with awe and wonder, perhaps as Dawson Jordan had done a century earlier. He sensed his father's presence with him everywhere he went, whenever some little detail of the game struck a chord of memory of James Jordan pitching the ball to him in the backyard. Jordan would tell himself, "We're doing this together, you and I, Pops." He longed for the friendly encouragement that James had brought him every day of his basketball life. Although he would never show it or relent from the task, soon enough the challenge began to wear on him, as it did on his thousands of fans, who had come to Florida looking for the magnificent athlete who had thrilled them in hoops, only to find an awkward, hesitant figure so clearly out of place. After years as the alpha male in basketball, as Phil Jackson liked to call him, here he was just hoping to make the team. He found himself looking at the manager's lineup each day, something he hadn't had to do since that fateful day at Laney. His new teammates did have to concede at least one thing. The dude was not afraid to look bad. He laid it all out there, trying to beat it down to first base to turn his dinky grounders into hits. He came close several times, but rolled hitless through his first 10 at-bats. He was too tall, some said, and presented too big a strike zone. Even he agreed. "Look at these arms," he said, comparing his long limbs with those of his teammates. Among the many media who came to witness the spectacle was Steve Wolfe of Sports Illustrated, who filed a derisive account that his editors made into the infamous cover that declared, "Bag it, Michael. Jordan and the White Sox are embarrassing baseball. He had better tie his Air Jordans real tight if I pitch to him," Seattle Mariner fireballer Randy Johnson told Wolfe. "I'd like to see how much airtime he'd get on one of my inside pitches." Not everyone commenting in the piece was as brazen, and some sought to be quoted anonymously. George Brett, a former third baseman who had moved into the front office of the Kansas City Royals, was frank. "I know a lot of players don't want to see him make it, because it will be a slap in the face to them." Bob Green would later note that this was the same magazine that had used Jordan's image on its cover dozens of times to increase newsstand sales, and in TV ads promising readers all sorts of Jordan-related goodies if they would subscribe. Deeply wounded, Jordan vowed never again to speak to a representative of the magazine, and he never did, despite all that would come after. As always, such humiliation only stoked his fire. "I'm really trying to learn this game," he told those around him. A half dozen games into the preseason schedule, he finally reached base on a fielder's choice. His fielding was becoming slightly less of an adventure as well. In his first night game, played against the Twins, he made a nice play in the sixth inning in right field, then later hit the ball down the third baseline for a single. Right behind him, Dan Howitt knocked a home run, and like that, Michael Jordan had scored a run and was later mobbed by his teammates in the clubhouse. But there was no way he was going to be among the 25 who made the big league roster that season. A week before spring training broke, he was assigned to the Birmingham Barons in Alabama in the AA Southern League, a prospects league mostly for young talent. He spent the final week in Florida working with the other minor leaguers, a 31-year-old hopeful among pimply teenagers. Sweet Home Chicago. On April 7th, Jordan returned to Chicago to play in the Windy City Classic, a big league exhibition game between the White Sox and Cubs at Wrigley. At first, Sox manager Gene Lamont wasn't going to start him, but 35,000 fans showed up to see him play. To their roaring delight, Jordan walked out in the first inning, his shades artfully resting over the bill on his cap. He went 2-for-5 with 2 RBIs in a game that was called a 4-4 tie after 10 innings. His able play in right field and his work at the plate drew standing ovations, so rare for baseball, from the happy crowd. "What a day for Michael Jordan," declared Cubs broadcaster Harry Carey. Before the contest, Carey had interviewed Jordan, who made no effort to contain his broad, boyish smile. Jordan was doing just what every kid dreamed of doing, Carey acknowledged. But he wanted to know, would he be upset if he made all of this effort only to discover he couldn't hit big league pitching? "No," Jordan replied, "that would simply be a credit to the game of baseball. He was there to see if he could do it, and to have fun trying," he explained. His associates would later remark that it was easily the happiest day of his baseball life, if not the happiest ever. The game, broadcast on Superstation WGN, served notice to viewers nationwide that perhaps this Jordan baseball thing wasn't so silly after all. The next day he arrived in Birmingham to find the place aswarm with thousands of fans. They had come from all over the country, a great Jordan tide that would continue to wash over minor league baseball in the coming weeks, setting attendance records and stripping the souvenir booths of every available item. J.A. Adonde traveled to Birmingham to do a story about the phenomenon for the Washington Post. "I remember going down there and just sitting there and looking at him out in the outfield, and it just seemed surreal," he recalled. "This is Michael Jordan, and he's sitting here in this ballpark, a minor league ballpark in Birmingham, Alabama. How is this possible?" Bob Green, too, was struck by the spectacle of thousands of people sitting for hours one night in a downpour during a rain delay just for the hope of seeing him play. Jordan had been profoundly embarrassed during spring training at the spontaneous outbreak of fans chanting, "I want to be like Mike." That kind of fervor was unheard of in Major League spring training, but this was the minors, the backwater of baseball, and still they came and ogled and chanted. He rewarded them with 7 strikeouts in his first 9 at-bats on the opening weekend of the season in Birmingham. He connected twice, one a pop fly, the other a groundout. The press corps, with many familiar faces from his basketball days, was startled by the absence of that old sparkle of supreme confidence in his eyes. "It's been embarrassing, it's been frustrating, it can make you mad," he told longtime hoops writer Ira Burkow of the New York Times. "I don't remember the last time I had all those feelings at once, and I've been working too hard at this to make myself look like a fool. For the last 9 years, I lived in a situation where I had the world at my feet. Now I'm just another minor leaguer in the clubhouse here trying to make it to the major leagues." He explained that the seed was planted way back in 1990, before he had hoisted a championship trophy. "It began as my father's idea," he said. "We had seen Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders try 2 sports, and my father had said that he felt I could have made it in baseball too. He said, 'You've got the skills.' He thought I had proved everything I could in basketball, and that I might want to give baseball a shot. I told him, 'No, I haven't done everything. I haven't won a championship.' Then I won it, and we talked about baseball on occasion. And then we won 2 more championships, and then he was killed." He didn't hesitate to speak of his father's presence with him as he went about the business of realizing that dream. "I talked to him more in the subconscious than actual words," he said that first weekend, talking as he sat in front of his new locker in the Barron's spacious clubhouse. "Keep doing what you're doing," he'd tell me. "Keep trying to make it happen. You can't be afraid to fail. Don't give a damn about the media." Then he'd say something funny, or recall something about when I was a boy, when we'd be in the backyard playing catch together like we did all the time. The bus. Word quickly got out that Jordan was buying an expensive new bus so that he could travel the back roads of the South in luxury with his new teammates. It wasn't true. He didn't even rent the bus, as he had offered. The Barron's regular bus supplier had simply decided to provide the team with a deluxe bus, complete with reclining chairs and a lounge in the back, to help ease the boredom of those long stretches between Nashville and Raleigh and Greenville and Orlando. Jordan explained that the nicer bus gave him room to stretch out, but he admitted there was another reason. "I don't want to have a bus break down at 1 o'clock at night in the South," he said. "You don't know who's going to be following you. I don't want to be caught in a predicament like that. I think about what happened to my dad." Those same thoughts had prompted him to purchase 2 firearms, which he kept in his suburban Chicago home. Always aware of his surroundings, he had become even more watchful in the wake of his father's murder. There was talk of him bonding with all the minor leaguers around him, and he did play dominoes in a back area of the clubhouse for light cash, which gave his teammates the opportunity to peer into his wallet fat with bills. But often he kept to himself, sitting alone during the long bus rides. That was the same emotional barrier that had existed on every team he had ever played on since he was 6 years old. Back in Chicago, he had confided to Johnny Bock the alienation he felt for years as a kid in baseball, as the only black on a team of whites. Those earliest experiences in baseball had also shaped him. Much of Phil Jackson's work as a coach had focused on breaking down the barriers between Jordan and the rest of the team. This spin through the minor leagues brought back those early moments with his dad, as well as the old alienation. So the distance between Jordan and his minor league teammates wasn't surprising. He wasn't rude or ugly or arrogant, not in baseball. But he did keep to himself and his entourage, which had shrunk to just George Kohler. Juanita would visit and bring the kids on some weekends, but most of the time it was Jordan, Kohler, and his grief. Jack McCallum had pushed Jordan to talk about the experience in 2011, which prompted a somewhat testy reply. "It was baseball," he said, "the Barrens. There were a lot of lonely nights out there, just me and George on the road talking, and I'd think about my father and how he loved baseball, and how we always talked about it. And I knew he was up there watching me, and that made him happy, and that made me happy too." Having grown up in North Carolina, Jordan found Alabama no great culture shock. He settled into a rented house in Birmingham with a basketball goal that allowed him to engage the neighborhood kids. He found the area's best golf courses and rib joints and pool halls. Soon enough, a relaxed Jordan produced a 12-game hitting streak that pushed his average up over 300. But then he struggled through a prolonged slump as the season stretched into the dog days of summer. He is attempting to compete with hitters who have seen 350,000 fastballs in their baseball lives and 204,000 breaking balls, Rangers pitching instructor Tom House would say of Jordan that season. "Baseball is a function of repetition. If Michael had pursued baseball out of high school, I don't doubt he would have wound up making as much money in baseball as in basketball. But he's not exactly tearing up Double A, and that's light years from the big leagues." When Jordan had announced his retirement the previous October, Lacey Banks had written a column the next day predicting that he would one day return to basketball. With his batting average sinking, Banks came to Birmingham for 3 days to push him on the issue, but Jordan denied it. "I still don't buy it," Banks wrote in the Sun-Times, "and his recent batting slump is our ally." Sitting at his locker, Jordan laughed when Banks asked him about a glorious return to the NBA. "You make it sound like some kind of religious event or something," Jordan snickered. Jordan was very adamant that his basketball days were behind him, recalled J.A. Adonde, who had worked with Banks at the Sun-Times. And Lacey goes back and asks him, "Is there even a teeny-weeny chance?" And Michael said something like, "There's always a chance, but right now it's real teeny and real weeny." Even with that dismal slump, Barron's manager Terry Francona could see that Jordan was making dramatic improvement. At his lowest point, he had stayed after a game one night to ask what the manager really thought about his future in the game. Jordan would admit later that the talk had come just as he had begun to entertain thoughts of giving up. He didn't want to go on as a joke and, worse, to take the place of a younger prospect who had a better chance. But Francona pointed out that progress was typically slow in baseball development and that he was starting to see substantial gains for Jordan. The effort had been extraordinary and unfathomable to people who knew baseball. Over the last month of the season, he batted .260, which lifted his average to a measly .202. In 436 at-bats, he had managed 88 hits, including 17 doubles and a triple. He had stolen 30 bases and scored 46 runs. Such steady improvement earned him a promotion. He was assigned to the Scottsdale Scorpions of the Arizona Fall League. It seemed to represent a victory, although few beyond Terry Francona and some White Sox executives saw it that way. For Jordan himself, it represented a murky window to his future. His once magnificent confidence was now in tatters all around him. Yet he remained cautiously steadfast, He was driven by emotions that few, if any, understood. He had arrived at this point in his life so completely wrapped in silent fury that even he failed to recognize it. This blinding yet unarticulated rage would play out in incongruous ways over the coming years, until the central question of his life became, would he ever be rid of it? Chapter 31. Come Again. As long, tall Michael Jordan busied himself trying to match the rhythm of his swing to the rhythm of the pitcher, he was also keeping an eye on the world he had left behind. He had kept up with the adventures of the Bulls and was amused by the NBA's feeble attempts to replace him as the marketing engine for the game. He was particularly curious to follow Pippen's breakout year that spring of 1994. No longer under Jordan's shadow, his old sidekick had shown surprising growth as a premier player. He had been named the MVP of the All-Star Game in February, and on the season had averaged 22.0 points, 8.7 rebounds, 5.6 assists, and 2.9 steals per game, as the Bulls posted 55 wins that year, just two fewer than the previous season with Jordan. At first glance, the team appeared to be doing quite well, but behind the scenes, Pippen's anger simmered. The Bulls made their way through the Eastern Conference playoffs to a showdown with the Knicks that saw Chicago fall behind 2-0. Game 3 was suddenly critical, and the Bulls started off poorly, only to charge back in the fourth period. With just 1.8 seconds left, New York's Patrick Ewing scored inside to tie the game at 102. On the bench during the ensuing timeout, Phil Jackson drew up a play that called for Pippen to inbound the ball to Tony Kukoc for a final shot. Pippen cursed the coach and sat on the bench, fuming and refusing to go back in. Andrea Kramer, an ESPN reporter with a camera crew just feet away, witnessed the entire scene, including the anger and shock of Pippen's teammates. Bill Cartwright, in particular, was both stunned and furious. Nonplussed, Jackson directed Pete Myers to inbound the ball. Kukoc caught it and swished a 22-footer as time expired for a dramatic victory, the fourth such game he had won that season with a last-second shot. Any celebration, however, was overshadowed by the outrage over Pippen's actions. It was explained to the media that Pippen had felt disrespected, that with the year he had had, he felt the final shot should have been his. Hardly mentioned was Pippen's simmering envy of the European player, who in his first year already had a salary to rival his own. After the game, Jackson told reporters, as far as the last play goes, Scottie Pippen was not involved in the play. He asked out of the play. That is all I'm going to say about it. Phil and I kind of exchanged some words, Pippen told reporters in the locker room afterward. That was pretty much it. It wasn't Phil taking me out of the game. We pretty much exchanged words and I took a seat. I think it was frustration. We really blew this game as much as we possibly could. We were able to pull off the win. Tony made another outstanding shot and it was a well-called play by Phil. Jordan, in Birmingham, was transfixed. Poor Scotty, he told reporters, little realizing at the time how much the incident would come to affect his own career. I kept telling him it's not easy being me. Now he knows. Jordan felt sorry for Pippen, and he knew that the incident was going to cause his friend much trouble. I apologize to the team and to Phil Jackson, Pippen told reporters several days later. I don't think I have to apologize to anyone else. The Bulls ultimately lost the series to the Knicks in 7 games. It was a devastating thing, Steve Kerr said at the time. Scotty never could have judged the magnitude of his actions. I felt so badly for him. Krause was infuriated by the incident. Pippen had already spent much of the season engaged in a nasty public argument with the GM over his contract. I don't think you can call me a quitter, Pippen said in defending himself. I think you can look at it and say I made a stupid mistake. That's pretty much it. I haven't been a quitter. I think I go out and approach the game as hard as anyone. I play smart, I play hard, and I play as a team player. Although Pippen was considered one of the best in the league, Krause began efforts to trade him, but had trouble finding a deal that would net a player of comparable value. Finally, Krause put together a trade with Seattle that would have brought power forward Sean Kemp plus a draft pick, which would allow Krause to select Eddie Jones, a bright young guard out of Temple. But at the last minute, Seattle's owner backed out of the trade, and the subsequent series of news stories revealed Krause's plans. Pippen, who was already unhappy over his contract, was further enraged that the team planned to trade him. The lingering hard feelings set the tone for a tumultuous offseason. Horace Grant, who was a free agent, became engaged in a similarly messy feud with Jerry Reinsdorf and soon left the team to sign with the Orlando Magic. In the acrid atmosphere, Cartwright announced his retirement, only to resurface on the Supersonics. John Paxson also decided to retire. Jackson watched the breakup of his very good team while involved in testy negotiations of his own with Krause for a new contract. The coach had already executed the offseason's most questionable move when he abruptly fired Johnny Bock just days after the playoffs ended. The dismissal came at a terrible time in the older assistant coach's life, just weeks before his 70th birthday. The irony, Bock recalled, was that the coaching staff had probably never worked better together than during the 1994 season. At the end of that year, I had every reason to think my contract would be renewed, Bock recalled. The first person that told me was Phil. He said, "We're not going to renew the contract." I was stunned. Before I could say much in defense, he said, "It's really best for you that you do leave. The organization has made up its mind." I was disappointed. Shocked is a better way of saying it. I didn't quarrel. I just couldn't believe it. I went to see Krause and he said the same thing. I just got up and left. I had a lot of crisis in my life at that time. I was in the divorce courts, ending a long-term marriage. I had to move. I thought everything was collapsing around me that summer. Then I had a heart attack. It was all a shock, and it took some time to believe and trust people again. The mysterious dismissal smacked of retaliation. Bock had apparently fallen into Jackson's disfavor because he had at times encouraged Jordan to follow his own instincts and ignore the triangle offense. Some in the organization felt that Bock's relationship with Jordan threatened Jackson's control of the team, even though Bock was also a strong supporter of Jackson's. There was clearly something about Bock that annoyed Jackson. "We were very different people," Bock acknowledged. At the time, and in accounts several months later, Jackson portrayed Bock's firing as a result of Krause's anger over the Jordan rules. It was Jerry Krause's relationship with Johnny Bock that created a very uncomfortable situation, Jackson said of the firing several months later. "It made this have to happen eventually. It had gone all wrong. It was bad for the staff to have this kind of thing, because we had to work together." Jerry basically blamed Johnny Bock for a lot of the things in the Jordan rules, and there's no doubt that Johnny did provide that information. Jerry felt that Johnny talked too much, and Johnny, in retrospect, felt that animosity that Jerry gave back to him, the lack of respect, so Johnny refused to pay allegiance to Jerry just because he was the boss. "It had gone on for too long a period of time," Jackson said. "I could have kept them apart, at bay from one another, I suppose, for a while longer, but I didn't like the fact that it wasn't good teamwork. That was my staff and my area. I agreed to do it. I felt it was a good opportunity because Johnny had an opportunity to get another job in the league quickly. It worked out fine for Johnny, although I would just as soon have not put him through the disappointment or have to go through the situation myself." It would be several years before events revealed that Jackson was seeking to cover up his own role in the book. Sam Smith eventually disclosed to Reinsdorf that Jackson, not Bock, was among the sources for the book. Reinsdorf violated Smith's confidence to reveal Jackson's role in the book to Krause. The revelation instantly infuriated the GM, who alleged that Jackson had deceived him into believing that Bock was the anonymous source for most of the inside detail. Smith later independently confirmed these events and Jackson's role in his book. "Phil and the players had much more of a role than Johnny Bock," Smith said. "Phil lied to me," Krause said when asked about the matter. "Phil actually got Johnny fired." "It was Phil's idea to fire Bock," Jerry Reinsdorf alleged as well. "Phil told me that the bad relationship between Krause and Bock had made things impossible. It was Phil's idea. Nobody told him to do it." Once he recovered from the heart attack, Bock was eventually hired by the Charlotte Hornets. It was several years before he learned the alleged reason for his firing, that he had supposedly provided the inside information to Smith. Bock said he went back and read the book three or four times looking for damaging information he might have provided. His quotes, though, were on the record and hardly scandalous. "I didn't see a single quote in that book that was out of order," he said. "Sam is obviously a good investigative reporter. There was a portrait in there that Michael did not like, based on whoever gave it to Sam. The book was quite an accurate portrayal," Bock said. "I don't think Sam painted someone as he wasn't." Krause said he was distraught that he had been deceived into firing an innocent man. By the time the lie was uncovered, several years later, Bach was working in Detroit as an assistant coach. One night when the Pistons were in Chicago to play the Bulls, Pistons executive Rick Sund told Bach that Krauss would like a word with him. Bach had mixed feelings but agreed to the meeting, and was more than a bit surprised. "When Jerry spoke to me, he was emotional, and so was I. I always thought the organization had made that move, not Phil. I thought it was a huge concession on Jerry's part to come up to me. I thought he meant it," Bach said of Krauss's apology, "and I accepted that." Bach would later address the issue with Jackson, but what was said would remain between the two of them. Bach said, "I'd rather leave it be. Certainly he knew how I felt. I always thought we had a relationship that was strong enough. We had sat there on the bench together for 5 years. As an assistant coach, you don't always know about these things that are going on. It was always foolish, kind of an indictment that I could never defend myself. Now the whole thing is not important. Once it was." The incident, however, revealed an intriguing element of Jackson's strategy with Jordan. Why had he risked the job he had coveted, or that key relationship with the game's brightest star, by providing a reporter with information about his boss or about Jordan? One longtime Bulls employee who worked with Jackson on a daily basis figured the coach did it to gain more control over his team. After all, the book had served to further alienate Krauss from the players, thus securing Jackson's role as their leader, the team employee said. It was, "Let's get down on Michael, let's whip this guy and keep him in line for my purposes." It was his way of getting on Michael's side by alienating him from the media, the Bulls employee suggested. That was why Phil always used, "It's the us against the media approach, the us against the organization approach," because if he did that, then he could be the leader of the pack. For years, the coach did not address the allegations by Reinsdorf and Krauss, although in a 2012 interview, Jackson pointed out that the Jordan rules had been immensely important in the evolution of the Bulls because it brought Jordan down to a level that was closer to his teammates. Certainly, Jackson was within his rights as a coach to want to speak with one voice to his players, but he had resorted to an extreme subterfuge to exert control. "Phil is the master of mind games," Jordan had said of the coach on several occasions. Jordan was dismayed at the news of his favorite coach's dismissal, although he had no idea what had really happened. On numerous occasions in the future, he would make a point of involving Bach in his life. Yet Jordan also reflected on the special relationship he shared with Jackson, the long talks they had, the debates and exchanges, not just about basketball, but about life in general. "We talked about so many different things," Jordan said of those sessions. "We used to get into philosophies more than anything." It was obvious that both he and Jackson enjoyed the talks immensely. "We used to challenge each other," Jordan said. "I think I would learn from him, and he used to learn a little bit from a player's perspective at that time. He had played years back, but I was giving him a thought process for a new era. It was a lot of give and take, much more listening from me. Not disagreements, but more or less concepts, with him saying, 'Think about this and think about that.'" The implicit running theme, ironically, had been greater trust. Jordan would recall that his trust in Jackson grew over time. As he won Jordan over and the Bulls began claiming championships, the coach found new ways to motivate the superstar and to maintain offensive balance between Jordan and his teammates. From there, Jackson pulled together an array of influences to shape Jordan's mental approach to performing under intense pressure. Obviously, those lessons had aided Jordan not just in basketball, but in his baseball life as well. The Stadium Again. That September, Jordan came to Chicago to play in the Scottie Pippen All-Star Classic, a benefit game for Jesse Jackson's Operation Push. At first, he was hesitant to accept the invitation, perhaps because of hard feelings left over from the boycott 4 years earlier. However, the event would afford him one final chance to play in Chicago Stadium, which was scheduled for demolition in the coming months, to make way for the $150 million United Center, just across Madison from the stadium. The lure of the stadium proved too strong, and Jordan showed up to find a packed house eager to reclaim him. His team, dressed in white, took on Pippen's crew in red, and the two old teammates went at each other with surprising fierceness. Jordan didn't want anyone thinking that he'd lost this or lost that. He found his old fire and took 46 shots for the game, making 24 of them for 52 points. His group won 187-150, in an evening that may have set a record for standing ovations. When it was over, he embraced Pippin near the scorer's table, waved to the crowd, and walked to center court, where he hitched up his shorts and bent over on all fours to kiss the floor, a final, emotional farewell to the platform of his rise to greatness. "I was kissing the stadium goodbye and kissing goodbye to my years of playing there," he told reporters afterward, "but I was not kissing basketball goodbye. I'll always love basketball, and I'll always play it. I just won't play organized ball." Indeed, he played quite a bit of pickup ball that fall in Scottsdale, where he went to play in the Arizona Fall League. Terry Francona had noticed that in Jordan's final month in Birmingham, he had begun driving the ball much harder when he hit it. His bat speed had improved, and he was starting to gain a base in his spindly lower body. Indeed, he hit a respectable 255 at Scottsdale, in a league of the game's top young prospects. Bob Green went to Arizona with Jordan and noted the lonely, wind-swept nature of the experience, the chilly games before mostly empty bleachers. Later that fall, Dolores Jordan phoned her son and detected something in his voice that told her she needed to visit him. A few days later, George Kohler picked her up at the airport and took her to the stadium for his game. The crowds were relatively sparse in Arizona compared with Birmingham, but Green watched Jordan step out of the dugout that evening and stand there, searching the crowd until he found her. Then his eyes lit up and he smiled broadly, a rare sight during his months of grief. Later that fall, he returned to Chicago for a salute to Michael, a ceremony to retire his number 23 jersey in the Bulls' brand new arena. In conjunction, the team planned to unveil a bronze statue of his heiress in action called The Spirit outside the new building. The statue was a burden to Jordan. He had seen a model of it and had somehow agreed to it, but his elevated public image had already made his life a nightmare. "He was a real person," he confided to Green, "not a statue, and its presence outside the United Center only served to further wall him in." It was an immediate hit, however, attracting countless tourists from around the country and around the world. Jordan's better sense warned him to avoid the ceremony, and it proved to be even worse than he had imagined, packaged as it was into a nationally broadcast program for TNT. After a series of staged segments and awkward skits, Reinsdorf and Kraus were introduced, and the crowd of 21,000, still quite angry over the team's summer of discontent, booed lustily. "Come on now," Jordan chastised the fans. "Both Jerrys are good guys." It wasn't as if the two Jerrys hadn't heard it before. At virtually every rally or celebration of the Bulls' three straight championship seasons, from 1991 to 1993, Kraus had been the target of merciless booing from Chicago crowds. Trainer Chip Schaefer, sitting nearby, could see Kraus's wife Thelma break down in tears during the booing. The GM had long ago inured himself to the anger of fans, but the sight of his wife in tears, being consoled by Dean Smith, made him furious. "Dean came up to her later on and said that it was nice of Michael to mention my name," Kraus recalled. Thel looked at him and said, "Too late. Bullshit, that's too damn late. He could have done a lot more earlier." "Dean was pretty pissed. I was really proud of my wife. She said that to a couple of people that night. She told Dean Smith off. She told several people off that night. She was pissed. She sat there with tears in her eyes after that happened." Like his wife, Kraus resented Jordan's refusal to ever speak up in his defense. "Michael could have done a bunch of things through the years," Kraus said later, "but he didn't." "Jerry's never been able to project a good personal image," Phil Jackson observed at the time, "and that's been the thing that's destroyed his public persona as far as the audience goes here in Chicago. They see him as someone like the mayor. The mayor always gets booed in public. Jerry represents that kind of guy. He has to do a lot of the dirty jobs. He's done that to the point where he's sort of made himself an unlikable character." Nevertheless, Kraus had endured. "All general managers make mistakes," Reinsdorf said. "Jerry's incredibly loyal, but the main thing is that he gets results. He gets results because he works very hard, and he has a good eye for talent." "Poor Jerry's been kicked around from pillar to post by everybody, including me," longtime Chicago sportswriter Bob Logan said at the time. "But he got what he wanted in life. He's running the franchise. He's got three championship rings. Yet I don't think he's ever spent a day where he's completely satisfied. There's always something else he wants, or something that doesn't quite work out." Not long before Jordan's tribute, Kraus had admitted that he looked forward to having a team that won a championship without Jordan on the roster. "Jerry and I have talked about it," Kraus said frankly. "Hell yeah, we want to win after Michael because there is a certain vindication in it, and there is a certain personal thing in it. Yeah, I mean I have an ego. I don't think that it is huge, but it ain't small. And I think I'm good at what I do. And for one time, I want the world to say that I won, and it wasn't because of Michael." Unfortunately, he had missed his chance in the failed 1994 playoffs. Even on this night of retirement celebration, Phil Jackson sensed that the desire to play again was stirring within Jordan. Some NBA owners had mentioned quietly to Reinsdorf that maybe the league itself should offer him a major compensation package to lure him back to basketball. Afterward, a reporter asked Jordan if he could be lured back to basketball with a $100 million contract offer. "If I played for the money," he said testily, "it would be $300 million. If he played for money, he certainly wouldn't have been in baseball, where his light stipend was supported by his estimated $30 million in endorsement income that year. Major League Baseball had been paralyzed by a strike in August and had dragged on through the holidays that year and right into February. The minor leagues were not affected, so Jordan reported to spring training a week early, only to realize that the fight between owners and players over money wasn't going to end anytime soon. Then he had a misunderstanding with White Sox management over dressing room and parking arrangements. But what really drove him away was the growing sense that he would be used as a draw for spring training. He had absolutely no appetite to be a replacement player, or worse, a scab. Finally, he packed up his father's dream for good and headed home. He notified Reinsdorf in a phone call. "I think you're quitting baseball for the wrong reasons," Reinsdorf said. "No," Jordan said, "I've made up my mind." "What do you want to do?" the owner asked. "I don't know," Jordan replied. He had hit 260 in the Arizona Fall League, Reinsdorf confided later. "I thought he was really making progress, but the strike had made it all but impossible for him to play for the White Sox in 95. On March 10th, he announced his retirement from baseball, saying that his minor league experience had allowed him to rediscover the work ethic that had made him a great basketball player. "I met thousands of new fans," he said, "and I learned that minor league players are really the foundation of baseball. They often play in obscurity and with little recognition, but they deserve the respect of the fans and everyone associated with the game." Jordan hadn't failed baseball, Phil Jackson noted. Baseball failed him. Berto Center Days. At first, Jordan tried to enter Bulls practices discreetly, but that wasn't likely to work out, especially with the team plodding through a drab landscape. The first warning was almost imperceptible. A cell phone call to an old friend, perhaps, or maybe a puff of smoke outside Jackson's office. Whatever it was, the signal somehow got transmitted to all the right people that March. MJ was thinking about coming back. He's just going to come to practice in his gear and see how things go. So began the year. The world truly lost its mind over Chicago basketball. "There were rumors for weeks about his coming back," recalled Chip Schaefer. "I was having dinner with Larry Christkowiak and Luke Longley and Steve Kerr, guys who hadn't played with Michael before. These guys were so excited about the prospects of playing with him, like kids almost in how they felt about it. I remember sitting there and listening to those guys and thinking, boy, you have no idea how hard it is playing with him." It had been a weird year even before Jordan got there, Steve Kerr recalled. The Bulls had been good without Jordan the previous season, but the 95 roster was considerably weaker. The dissension and controversy had finally caught up with them. "I felt like what happened was, the first year he was gone, his presence was still felt and the team still had a swagger," Kerr explained. "We had Cartwright and Paxson and Horace Grant, all these guys who were clearly still champions, and felt that way, and it carried over even with Michael gone. But by the next year, it had started to wear off. We missed Cartwright and Paxson and Grant. We missed their leadership. So all of a sudden, we were depleted physically and leadership-wise. And reality kind of set in. We just sort of faded and lost our edge and our energy. We were struggling." Jordan had been in and out of their practices earlier that season, but there hadn't been any bonding whatsoever with the team, Kerr said. "He came to practice some, occasionally, but he was really unapproachable for those of us who didn't play with him, just because of who he was and his presence. He's kind of an intimidating guy, as you know, especially if you don't know him. You just don't wander over to Michael Jordan and say, hey, what's up? He was like this looming presence, None of us knew him very well. Within days, he was in gear and in practice with enough energy to drive a storm surge, but it still wasn't clear if he had decided to return. The first leak came on local sports talk radio, and the madness was on. The next 10 days would bring the greatest tease in the history of sport. Was Michael Jordan returning to basketball? A village of satellite trucks and media representatives from the major networks and national publications converged on the practice facilities at the Berto Center in anticipation of some kind of announcement. Yet large screens covered the picture windows of the practice facility. The media could hear the shouts, the squeaking of sneakers on the gym floor. They were told that Jordan was practicing with the team, but that he hadn't yet made up his mind, that the details were being worked out. Meanwhile, in practice sessions, he wore the yellow vest of the second team and ran point guard against the regulars. Jordan versus Pippen, just like old times. "Just to be able to play with him is fun," said center Will Perdue, who had played on all three championship teams with Jordan. "Just to be able to watch him." In truth, the situation wouldn't have gotten so crazy, the hype so large, if it hadn't dragged on for those 10 teasing days. But Reinsdorf wanted him to wait, and Jordan himself wavered that week, pausing, trying to figure out if he was returning to basketball out of disappointment over the baseball strike, or if he was coming back because he loved the game. While he waited, the fans came in droves to the Berto Center as if drawn by a great magnet. The crowd spilled over into the parking lot of a hotel next door, eager to catch a glimpse of his airness as he left practice each day. But he remained silent, which kept the 24-hour cable news shows fed and lines buzzing on sports radio talk shows across the continent. After about a week, the collective impatience began to mushroom, with some callers on Chicago sports radio talk shows claiming that Jordan was toying with the public, which might have been true. David Falk, who noticed everything, savored the conditions. His client was generating the kind of coverage that couldn't be bought. USA Today reported that the stock value of those companies that employed Jordan as a spokesman had zoomed up $2 billion on the various stock exchanges in recent days, leading to further suggestion that Jordan was engaged in some kind of financial manipulation. By that Thursday, March 16th, Jackson signaled that it had all gotten to be too much. He told Jordan not to attend practice that day because the media crowd at the Berto Center had grown too large. That afternoon, the coach told the assembled media that Jordan and Reinsdorf were engaged in discussions and that a decision was probably 3 or 4 days away. Even with the monster distraction that he was, Jordan had shown that he could boost the team with just a little practice time. That Friday night, the Bulls capped a 3-game winning streak and raised their record 3 notches above 500 by defeating the Milwaukee Bucks in the United Center. There'd been speculation that Jordan might make a sudden appearance in uniform for that game, but only his security advisor showed up to evaluate the arena. Then, abruptly the next morning, Chicago radio stations reported that the deal was done, that Jordan would make his announcement that day, and that he would play Sunday in a nationally televised game against Indiana. Down on LaSalle Street, the managers at Michael Jordan's restaurant heard the news and decided to restock the gift shop yet again. The restaurant's business had been slow in February, but the hint of Jordan's return had crowds packing the place virtually every night in March. Fans kept a vigil at the Jordan statue outside the United Center, which had quickly become something of a shrine. Over at the Berto Center, a crowd of fans and reporters milled about, with some fans leaning from the balconies of the Residence Inn next door, all waiting for the official word. Suddenly, practice was over, and like that, Jordan's Corvette appeared on the roadway, with the fans cheering wildly as he gunned the engine and sped off. Next came Pippen in a Range Rover, pausing long enough to flash a giant smile through the vehicle's darkly tinted windows. Moments later, NBC's Peter Vesey did a stand-up report outside with the fans rooting in the background. He told the broadcast audience that Jordan was returning, that he would play against Indiana on Sunday, and would probably pull his old number 23 jersey out of retirement. Excitement coursed through the city. Chicago, quipped one radio sportscaster, was in a state of jorgasm. The Star of Stars had broken his silence with a 2-word press release issued through Falk. It read, "I'm back." That Sunday, Jordan violated NBA rules and flew down to Indianapolis on his private jet. The plane landed, and he sat alone inside it on the runway. He was about to play his first NBA game since his father's passing, and he wanted to let his mind roll back over some very personal memories. Then he rode downtown with an armada of limousines carrying his security force of 20. He would need them to negotiate the crowds that had gathered around Market Square Arena, where security workers had erected yet more barricades. Waiting for the game to start, Pacers coach Larry Brown took in the atmosphere and quipped that it seemed like Elvis and the Beatles are back. Finally, shortly after noon, he emerged with his teammates from the visitors' locker room and stood before a crowd gathered in the hallway. He chomped his gum, looked around with a serious frown, and made ready to resume the career that had been interrupted by an 18-month retirement. At last, the maddening foreplay was coming to an end, and the basketball public could celebrate the return of its pharaoh. All the high priests of hoop were there. NBC brought in the big guns for that one, recalled Matt Gukas, who had ascended to the role of color analyst. They even flew in Bob Costas to host the pregame show. If Jordan had decided to stage his own Super Bowl, it couldn't have seemed like a bigger deal. Surrounded on all sides by cameras, the Bulls made their way out into the arena, opening yet another chapter in the saga of Air Jordan. But there was something not right with the picture. He was wearing jersey number 45, his minor league and junior high number, instead of the familiar 23 that he had made so famous. He had decided to keep number 23 retired because it was the last number his father saw him wear, Jordan later explained. Champion, the sportswear manufacturer that held the NBA license for jerseys, immediately added an extra shift and began producing more than 200,000 number 45 jerseys for sale around the world. The crowd hardly seemed to care that he looked somewhat stiff and rusty against Indiana that afternoon. He made just 7 of 28 shots, but his defensive intensity helped the Bulls take the division-leading Pacers to overtime before losing. Afterward, he broke his silence to address the hoopla of the preceding 10 days. I'm human, he said. I wasn't expecting this. It's a little embarrassing. His return had been delayed while he sought assurances that the Bulls would keep Pippen and Armstrong, assurances that Reinsdorf declined to make. Jordan said he had also taken his time evaluating his own motives, making sure his love of the game was genuine. That, he said, was the reason he returned, not financial considerations. He pointed out that the league had a moratorium on renegotiating contracts while it worked out a new labor agreement with the National Basketball Players Association, so he was forced to play for the $3.9 million salary he had left behind in 1993. Although not required to, the Bulls had paid his full salary for 1993-94, and they would cover the full amount for 1994-95, although Jordan played only a portion of the season. His return, he said, was based solely on his love for basketball. I wanted to instill some positives back into this game, he said on his return, indicating his displeasure at some of the NBA's highly paid young players. There's been a lot of negatives lately, young guys not taking care of their part of the responsibility, as far as the love of the game. I think you should love this game, not take advantage of it. Be positive people and act like gentlemen, act like professionals. From there, the Michael Jordan comeback review headed to Boston Garden, where 3 nights later he scored 27 points by shooting 9 of 17 from the floor. This time the Bulls won. Next up, he treated his followers to a last-second shot for a win against Atlanta, setting up the big show at Madison Square Garden. Knicks coach Pat Riley had become alarmed when he saw that Jordan was already starting to get his rhythm back against the Hawks. Riley, one of pro basketball's most knowledgeable figures, knew when a storm was headed his way. Jordan and Falk sensed it coming too. Jordan had wanted 3 games to warm up before facing Riley's rough crew, with 6'5 John Starks, who had defended him well in the past. The Chosen One's return to Gotham would draw the largest regular season attendance in the history of cable network TNT's NBA coverage, and the city itself bristled with excitement. Bulls over Broadway flashed a huge marquee near the garden. All anyone could talk about was the history. Nothing lit up Jordan's eyes like New York's grand venue, dating from his rookie season. The garden had been the site of statement after statement, the loudest of which came in his return from foot injury in 1986, when he set the building record for points scored by an opponent with 50. This night had that same feel, with his aura thick in the atmosphere. I came out here to score, he said afterward, as if he needed to explain himself. Everybody had seen that in those first New York minutes. His jump shot started falling in the opening quarter as Starks backed off just enough to prevent his drive. He allowed Jordan to get into what he liked to call his rhythm, that flow he sought in everything he did, from batting to golf to basketball to table tennis with Lacey Banks. From there, he seized the Knicks by the throat, and even Spike Lee and the courtside homers were secretly delighted. His scoring line was 49 by the end of the third quarter, and he went on to break his own garden.